That's Monty Alexander with Bob Marley's The Heathen. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Friday, November the 16th. A lot to talk about and a lot to take stock of, but that's your charge. Your charge today is to contribute your thoughts, and let's share them. I could get the ball started by talking about now is the time. Now is the time. What do I mean? The election afforded us an opportunity to reevaluate things. It's not just about whether the Democrats are up against the Republicans and who is winning and who is losing in the red states and the blue states and all of that. The fact is, we are in a sad state. We are in a sad state. And if we continue with the illusion that somehow we could manage things, or that we can cede our own authority to a larger body that has a history of betrayal of interests, a history of partisanship, a history of self first, then we are sadly mistaken. Communities of color in particular should have paid attention and should be paying attention to unfolding events. And don't get me wrong, I understand that there are national interests that we ought to be paying attention to, but I am going strictly local, strictly local, almost to the point of the super micro level. What is it that you and I, as individuals, have to do? What is it that we have to do to make sense of our reality? We are finite human beings with a finite amount of time and energy and talent and resources, and we are cast in a world with infinite problems. So all the more reason to be really clear about how we use our resources, our time, our efforts, our energy, our talents. What do we do? Well, if we profess to be community-minded, it means we pay attention to ourselves as in its terms of what it is we have to offer, what it is we can do, and what the needs are. I have a huge issue, and you know, I'm not alone. I have huge issues with what we have as leadership in our communities, elected and non-elected. It's way below par, substandard almost in the extreme. And yet, the indications are that we're so fed up, we feel so overwhelmed, we feel so overburdened, outmatched, that we can't hope even to make a difference, because we are drowning in a tidal wave of mediocrity. Everywhere it exists. And I've got to tell you, I'm there with you. You know, I can't believe the mediocrity. Gary was just talking about mediocrity in the media and in leadership as well. It was amazing, because that's exactly where I'm going. I'll give you an example. We have in Chicago Jesse Jackson Jr., who has been absent from Congress for several months now, almost going on half a year, ostensibly because he is suffering with a mental illness. But he hasn't shown up for work. He hasn't talked to anybody. He hasn't said a word to his constituency. And basically his attitude is, hey, what are you worried about? This congressional seat is mine. It's personally mine. It belongs to me, and I'm doing with it whatever it is I want. What trouble is it to you? I don't have to talk to you. Now, that's bad enough. Here's what's worse. He was re-elected. You understand this? He was re-elected. And not marginally re-elected. Very healthily re-elected. Vigorously re-elected. I don't know what that means in terms of what the constituency, his congressional district, is thinking. But it seems to me that that is the kind of contempt that we have internalized as a community, and we accept it. There should be people in his district marching down to his office saying, make up your mind. If you're that sick, you can't hold office. You ought to be out. We're sorry that you're under this pressure, but if you think you have mental illness, why not ask us what we have? This is Chicago. And as you've been listening here, the city of Chicago is a super stressed city for anybody black right now. And we have this kind of thing going on. And the arguments, people are actually making excuses for this. They're saying, well, you know, we have other people who have been out because, you know, they've had health problems. Well, yes, I could see with Congresswoman Gibbons, who was shot in the head. This is not the case with Jesse Jackson Jr. And I am not so naive as to believe that this is about mental illness, and I don't want to decry mental illness. I know there are people of all walks of life. But I am also mindful of the fact that he's under investigation. The federal authorities are looking into his management of his campaign funds. There is a question about what role, if any, he played in trying to secure the vacated seat of Barack Obama in Chicago via bribery. I also am aware that his wife, who is an alderman, there are issues there. She doesn't live in Chicago. She lives, it has been documented and reported regularly, she lives in Washington, D.C., in a house that itself is under investigation because there are allegations that campaign money was used to decorate the house. But their children go to school in Washington, D.C. This is a kind of madness that we have. And we tolerate it and we say, well, you know, we got to give the brother a break. You know how things are. No. No. I cite Jesse Jackson Jr. just because he is typical of the kind of contempt that many black elected officials have for their own communities. But in the case of Jackson, it has a special tinge because the attitude is, this belongs to me. This political office that I have is my own personal possession. I am entitled to it. That is the attitude I have encountered so many times among black elected officials. And they're not unique. White elected officials do it too. It is an attitude pervasive in politics. But I cite this because this is the kind of leadership that we have too much of in communities that are distressed, that are looking for competent leadership, accountable leadership, leadership that gets things done. It's not about you and your career and the fact that being a congressman entitles you to $176,000 a year as a salary and your health benefits and so forth. And by the way, here's what's interesting. Jesse Jackson Jr. reportedly is in conversation. His lawyers, while he's suffering this mental illness, his lawyers are busy negotiating with the federal authorities. And there's a rumor that he will soon, they're trying to make a deal to see if he will resign. And there too is a very interesting thing. Why are you making a deal? Why is there a need to make a deal with anybody in law enforcement if you haven't been charged with a crime? He hasn't been officially charged with a crime. And his lawyers are making a deal. Which means he is using his congressional seat, his office, as leverage. I am not leaving here until I get a deal. The heck with the people and what they need in this time, in this period of time, in crazy Chicago. It's all about me. And me-ism is pervasive throughout our communities. The African American, Latino, people of color, we have it, too much of it. So now is the time people should decide that there is no room, no more room for this kind of nonsense. Black, white, or polka dot, if you are in a position of leadership, you better lead. And if you're not up to it, get out of the way. We see the lineage here, the political lineage, and Jesse Jackson Jr. is performing as Jesse Jackson Sr., whose attitude simply is, well, I marched with Martin Luther King, which he did. I put my 2 cents in the pot in the civil rights era, which he did. Therefore, I am entitled to commodify my contribution. I'm entitled to monetize it. And so I can steal an entire coalition, take it unto myself as my own personal possession and use it as leverage in my consultancy gigs. And the hell with the Rainbow Coalition and what it intended to do originally. I have no allegiance to that, but it does look good on my letterhead when I am out making speeches and I'm under the warm glow of the television lights, and I'm transacting business for me. And the Rainbow Coalition still has not stepped up and said, you know what? We made you. You did not make us. We own our movement. They still have not done that piece of work. So it's a two-way relationship. We have leaders misbehaving, behaving very badly, and we have the people behaving very badly as well. When are we going to get serious? I suggest that now is the time. You look at every possible indicator of progress, of quality of life, of education, of basic necessities and needs. And you see a yawning gap between the rich and the poor. And in almost all aspects, Black and Latino elected officials are representing distressed communities, almost 100%. And yet, you could probably not even count on one hand the number of elected officials who rise above the level of mediocrity in terms of what it is they are returning to constituencies who place their trust and their faith and their hope in them. But then we sit back. And we say, okay, you're the leader, go ahead and lead, and we will go about our lives, hoping that you do the right thing. And then come see us in the next 2 years if you're in Congress, or see us in the next whatever term it is that you're running for. And we'll flick that lever again and put you back in office. I give you this other point. Harlem. Harlem, New York. We go from Chicago to Harlem. Harlem was the seat of Black political power in the state of New York. And in some cases, when Adam Clayton Powell was alive, it was the seat of Black political power nationally. That's the level at which Adam Clayton Powell functioned. His leadership was not bound by geography. He was a leader for all people, not just Black folks either. To this day, there are few, if any, leaders in Congress to match and equal his productivity as a legislator. And mind you, he was in Congress in its most trenchant racist time and managed to get so much legislation passed that benefited an entire constituencies far outside Harlem. Minimum wage, Powell. On-the-job safety, Powell. Student loans, Powell. Not just for Black folks, but a human rights agenda was what propelled him. Naturally, he had his constituents in mind and their benefit and their welfare, but we don't see that. Harlem was supposed to be, and Harlem claimed it was, the seat of Black political power. We had a Secretary of State, Basil Patterson from Harlem. The State Comptroller, H. Carl McCall, came from Harlem. A city clerk who was in the State House and then went on to become mayor, David Norman Dinkins. He had the fourth most powerful member of Congress coming out of Harlem, Charles B. Rangel. You had a governor coming out of Harlem, Mr. David Patterson. You had the leader of a political party, the Democratic Party, coming out of Harlem, Denny Farrell. You had a borough president, in fact, more than one, coming out of Harlem. So you have huge assets politically imbued and embedded in Harlem. So now explain Harlem to me. All this political might, and Harlem is a desert. Harlem does not exist anymore. Harlem is defenseless. Harlem is gutted. Harlem is completely at the whim of whomever wants to invade it. In fact, Harlem has been invaded. Harlem once had a thriving, self-controlled economic base. It no longer does. Harlem used to have affordable housing. No longer does. Harlem now has one of the highest low birth weights in the nation. Its schools are underperforming. The unemployment rate you don't want to discuss. They don't even bother asking about the teenage unemployment rate either, which people guess to be somewhere at 80% or higher. In every single way you can measure the health of a community, you can say that Harlem is exceedingly unhealthy. So, how do we square all of this political power, this political influence that was legitimized by people who were asked to support it, and the eventual consequences that would assail them? They are at their most powerless when, in fact, they are at their most powerful. That's a conundrum. And with all of this political power wrapped up in Harlem, Harlem has yet to do anything. I'm talking about the established political clout. It cannot serve its own geographic boundaries, let alone any place else. It's ineffective. It's impotent. And that is a case in point for so many black communities. The leadership is completely ineffective, and yet installed as a permanent feature of its political landscape. When I visited Harlem not too long ago, I was in New York, and directly across the street from where I was staying with friends was one of the biggest projects to come to Harlem in a long while. The building, I believe, a 7-story bus depot, which had been named for a wonderful, wonderful activist, Mother Hale, who became almost legendary in Harlem for taking care of abandoned children. Right up on the same block is the headquarters of the state assemblyman, Denny Farrell, who is also the leader of the Democratic Party in Harlem. Do you know, I'm just passing by the project on my way to the subway, and I glance within the confines of the construction site, and I see a huge gathering of workers. and they're talking about something. Then I see two African Americans literally at the gate. They're not with the rest of them. They're not with the rest of the people, and the rest of the people numbered, I would imagine, about 100 people or so, 80 to 100 people. And it was jarring to me. So I asked, I said, wait a minute, how many black people are working at this project? By the way, significantly, the project is on Malcolm X Boulevard, Malcolm X Boulevard, on 147th Street. And the people, I asked them, I said, how many blacks are working here? And the two people I saw at the gate started to grin. They kind of laughed, but it wasn't a funny laugh. It was one of those irony laughs that you get. They said, well, so far, today we're it. I said, what do you mean? One was the, they called her the flag woman. She was the person who would wave a flag for safety reasons to direct traffic. And the other told me he was a security guard. But in the middle of this project, in Harlem, on the same block, with the leader of the Democratic Party, who is the assemblyman for the district, on Malcolm X Boulevard, for a project named after a black woman, I didn't see a single black face in that meeting that they were having on the construction site, other than the two people who were at the gate, because apparently at that moment, their input would have been irrelevant. This had to do with real business. And of the people I saw assembled, again, I did not see a single black face. How could that possibly be? How could that possibly be? It is because the leadership has no commitment. It has no power. It has no interest in securing the needs of the people who elected it. So now is the time for people in the community, at the community level, to get real serious and do some heavy editing. Make this the last round of mediocre people that you put in office. Make this the last time you settle for this contempt. Make this the last time you tolerate this disrespect. I'll take a break. We'll come back to your calls and your ideas right after this short break. This is Lee's Stories. I'm Trace Lead on PRN.FM. The number to call is 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. In your head, what is it that you cite as being non-negotiable items from here on? You know, what is your version of now is the time? I'm interested. I'd like to know. By the way, if you'd like to continue the conversation, and many of you do, please do drop me a line at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. And, of course, I do my best to respond very, very quickly to your letters and notes. But this is an issue. People of color are reticent to be critical of their leadership. They don't want to say very much. They're embarrassed. And it holds the same, I think, across the board. People are very reticent. They just don't like the idea. But we've got to lay all kinds of things aside. It's in our interests to be vigilant and to be proactive. We have to stand up and speak up. And we may have to, pinch our noses a little bit while we do the job, but we got to do it. We got to clear folks out, clear them out, make this the last election cycle that we put up with this kind of nonsense passing as leadership, because we need to understand that that level of leadership is a reflection of our own values, of the degree to which we will tolerate this kind of nonsense. It is rampant, rampant within the Black and Latino communities. I know this. This level of leadership is rampant. And we don't seem to have the nerve to change it. We don't seem to have the willingness to change it. We need to start cultivating people who we think can assume the mantle of leadership, and they're there. We need to stop the cycle of politics being a career aspiration, i.e. a job. Well, let's face it, for many in these distressed communities, a regular salary at the rate that a city council seat would pay or a congressional seat would pay is very attractive. In their lives, they probably would never earn this kind of money, so they see it literally as an office to aspire to simply because it provides benefits that in the private sector they probably would not get to. So that is the attraction. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. If people see that as an incentive to go into politics, that's fine. But you can't tell me that's your only incentive. You can't tell me that's your only incentive. Would you believe that one of the talking points in the negotiations for Jesse Jackson Jr. is his retirement benefits from Congress? He says, I'm not going to walk unless, you guarantee me my retirement. This is absurd. Meanwhile, his congressional district has been leaderless for almost half a year. He's not talking to anybody. He doesn't see the need. After all, he's minding his business. And being in Congress is his personal business. So he doesn't have to account to anyone. 1-888-874-4888. We'll get to your calls as soon as you make them. 1-888-874-4888. In an election year, and we've seen signals from all over the country as to what the mindset is. We talked here about America becoming seriously bifurcated right now. You're either rich or you're poor. And now, increasingly, you're either white or you're not. So the leadership has to be exerted within the main arena as well. We have to find the voices that oppose racist or race-based thinking and action. I was happy to see that Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana stepping forward to distance or to condemn the statements by Mitt Romney that Barack Obama won because basically he placated those folks. Well, Jindal finally reacted as a man who recognized he was one of those folks. Or the terror that has descended in the state of Maine because the chairman of the Republican Party there was just terrorized by the idea that many black folks showed up to vote. Oh my God, how could this happen? If that's not an indicator as to where we are, if that's not one of the metrics that we need to use as to where we are as a country and what it is you need to do simply as a matter of self-defense, I don't know what else would serve as an indicator of what it is you need to do. The man actually says, everybody has a right to vote, but nobody in these towns, he's talking about rural Maine, nobody in these towns knows anyone who's black. How did that happen? I don't know. We're going to find out. Nobody I know in Maine knows anybody black. This is an entire state of Maine he's talking about. It is district. It is an entire district. He is so sure nobody knows anybody black. Black folks have been, until they showed up at the polls, completely invisible. And what is jarring to this man, chairman of the Maine Republican Party, Charlie Webster, what is jarring to him is that he's seen them for the first time at the polls. Oh my God, two things that probably set his heart racing. One, he finally saw black people. And two, my God, they're voting. I'm seeing them and they're voting. Two things that they're not supposed to do. They're not supposed to be visible and they're damn sure not supposed to be voting. And this is 2012. This is not a Republican mindset. This is the narrative that we live in. You're either white or you're not. We have to have that conversation. We have to see movement in the other communities as well. That they're not going to tolerate a race-based America. It is not the right thing. It is not the right way to go. They ought to definitively put a stake in the heart of that racist beast and kill it. And not look to black folks and Latinos to carry the burden of humanizing America. That's their job. Their job is to work within their own communities, to divest their communities of racist attitudes like this. That's their job. The job in communities of color is to make leadership accountable. Primary responsibility, make your leadership accountable. And do not tolerate mediocre leadership. Just don't do it. You know, we keep looking for solutions elsewhere, and they're right in front of us, just on the basis alone. If I were living right across the street from this seven-story superstructure that occupies an entire block. Now, this is a very large project. If, as a citizen, I'm walking past it and I can see that something is wrong there, but it goes on, then I too am culpable for the denigration of my community. But the fact that it is directly across one of the most active political pockets of voters, it's right across from an apartment complex called Esplanade Gardens. There are thousands of people living in Esplanade Gardens. And yet, this is the mockery that is going on directly across the street from them. And there's no impact. They say nothing, and they do nothing. How do you explain that? So now is a time to take stock. In our communities, we need to have an agenda. Third parties or alternative parties need to have a new agenda. Retool your agenda, tweak it, so that you have goals that are achievable and that you can win. Set your sights on something you can win. Don't present yourself for another election cycle with a losing proposition. Decide what you can do that you can organize around and win at, and win decisively in terms of coalition building. That's your job. It is not people's job to sign on to what you think the priorities are. It is your job to ascertain what people's priorities are so that they can be naturally involved. But we have this attitude that, okay, my party is about XYZ. We've decided that this is what we want to do. And therefore, you should be smart enough to sign on to it and become involved. That's not the way it works. That is a cultural arrogance. If you truly intend to make change, you therefore work with people where they are. Not where you want them to be, but where they are. And you build around what they identify as their priorities. And you kind of merge them with the priorities of the constituent parts of your movement as you envision it. But you don't decide, hey, this is what we're going to do. And if you're smart, you're going to join in. And if you don't join in, it's because you don't have a vested interest in it and you're not smart. That is not the way to go. They have to change that philosophy. Have the courage to actually come into the communities, to ascertain what life is like at ground level, to ascertain what people define as their priorities. So for alternative parties or alternative movements, this is the work that they have to start doing now. They will find out that there is a Grand Canyon's gap between what they envision as what the people need and what the people actually do need or want. But if there's courage in that kind of a movement, if there's sincerity in that movement, they will now begin to organize differently in order to incorporate the interests of the people that they say they want to help, and not maintain this arrogant attitude that they know better than everybody else. But the Black and Latino communities have to get ruthless and obsessive about their interests and do house cleaning and not tolerate the contemptuous leadership that they have. It's getting them nowhere. And they have repeated this cycle over and over again to the extent that you can actually consider this, you know, a psychological deficiency. Why would you elect somebody you know is not going to be good at what you want them to do? Why would you do that? There's a certain disconnect there, an internalization of inferiority. You feel entitled to inferiority. So you grapple inferiority to your breast with hoops of steel. You're not going to let it go because it's what you know and what it is you've become accustomed to. And anything different scares you. You start an organic cultivation program. You create your leadership. You nurture your leadership. You identify people with a capacity for leadership. And you bring them along. You mentor them. But you make no concessions on the matter of integrity. The Chicago example I cited is one of the extreme, but it is typical of what is going on in too many Black and Latino districts. And now is the time to begin the process of organizing to put an end to this nonsense. We can't afford it anymore. We should not have it. It is to our extreme disadvantage to have these people on the front lines of what we think is a defense. They are willing partners in the process of our destruction. They are compromised and they have little integrity. I want to thank you for the pleasure of your company today. We can continue the discussion, as I said, at leadstories@gmail.com. But I want you to stay tuned because coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Thanks.